I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And this podcast is a continuation of the series on the Paris Peace Conference in 1919. The thing I find interesting about the conference, one of the many things, is the fact that whilst the likes of Wilson, Clemenceau and Lloyd George were, and their various delegations were drawing up new national boundaries across Europe, the process of nation formation, successor states to the Austro-Hungarian, Russian, German and Ottoman empires was continuing apace happening on the ground. Revolutions, foundations of nation states, wars were being fought during the period of the Paris Peace Conference, and actually the pace of events moves faster than the conference itself is capable of actually going. And so the realpolitik really of the Paris Peace Conference is a very interesting and perhaps slightly overlooked aspect of the entire process. Normally, when you open a textbook on the Paris Peace Conference and the Treaty of Versailles, normally the first bit in any textbook on Nazi Germany, the impression you get is that the big three, and obviously Italy and Japan, but both of those peel away, but the big three make decisions and the rest of the world abides by them. Well, it is sort of true and sort of not, because, as mentioned, the struggle for national unification in Poland, for example, owes in many ways more to Germany than it does to the conference itself. It was the German, the Kaiserreich, that had instituted a kind of a puppet state in Poland following the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. And this was the foundation of a new Polish state. Of course, along with the struggles of Polish nationalists such as Paderewski and the Polish National Movement. So by the time the Supreme Council had first met on the 12th of January, Poland had been reborn as a nation. Finland and the Baltic states were close to independence. And Czechoslovakia had been appeased together. So these events all happen before there is even a first meeting between Wilson, Clemenceau and Lloyd George. The Balkans were another seat of dramatic change. Serbia and the South Slav territories of Croatia and Slovenia had formed into a Yugoslav state, which couldn't have existed without the demise from the late 19th century onwards of the Ottoman Empire and the destruction of the Austro-Hungarian Empire during the First World War. The Ottoman Empire, the Serbia had once obviously been a vilayet, a province of the Ottoman Empire, became a suzerain from the mid-19th century onwards, and Slovenia and Croatia had been the territories of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Margaret Macmillan quotes Lloyd George saying, "The task of the Paris treaty makers was not to decide what in fairness should be given to the liberated nationalities, but what in common honesty should be freed from their clutches when they had overstepped the bounds of self-determination." There's a marvellous anecdote about the difference between the pontifications of the delegates at the conference and the facts on the ground in Eastern Europe. You see those little holes, a local asked an American visitor to Lvov, on the disputed borders between Russia and Poland. We call them here Wilson's points. They've been made with machine guns. The big gaps have been made with hand grenades. We are now engaged in self-determination, and God knows what and when the end will be. So instead of seeing the Paris Peace Conference as the place where Poland was created, Poland was created by Polish people, by struggle within Poland. The very first issues that the Paris Peace Conference deal with when it comes to Poland isn't ratifying its existence, but dealing with fighting between Poland and its neighbours. And fighting was ongoing by 1920, obviously, when Poland defeated the Red Army at the gates of Warsaw. One interesting similarity between the end of the First World War and the end of the Second World War, there is no final treaty with Germany at the end of the Second World War, there's no Treaty of Versailles. There are several conferences, obviously, at Yalta and Potsdam. But in both instances, the idea that Europe is at peace in 1918, 1919, or Europe is at peace in 1945 is untrue. There's terrific inter-ethnic violence in nearly every country in Western and Eastern Europe in 1945. And there is an immense amount of inter-ethnic violence in mainly Eastern Europe in 1918-1919. The difference between the two is that the end of European empires, particularly the German, Austro-Hungarian and Russian in 1919, had seen the re-emergence of nation-states like Poland. Whereas the process is different in 1945, as we see the beginnings of the development of the Iron Curtain. But what we must be confident about is the idea that fighting was not over in Europe in 1919 and wouldn't be for some considerable amount of time to come. And the fact that we popularly assume it is shows a real kind of conceit within First World War historiography. There are not many books popularly available that address this issue. I know there is one title coming out, so I've kind of got my eye on. But popularly, we look at the Western Front as being the First World War. This is a very Anglocentric point of view. And when I say we, I know there are many of my listeners around the world that don't share this view, so I'm not talking to you. A particularly failure of imagination over Anglocentric historiography. We see the Western Front as having, you know, the guns falling silent in November 1918 and the Paris Peace Conference as being a event that happens in the aftermath. Well, the war was ongoing and the war in Europe evolved from a struggle between empires to ethnic violence, the wars that normally accompany the establishment of nation states, and the fight over resources and boundaries that normally accompany these sorts of processes. Tasker Bliss, the American military advisor, wrote to his wife from Paris saying that he believed there would be another 3 decades of fighting in Europe. He was slightly out with those predictions, but not wildly. He wrote, "The submerged nations are coming to the surface, and as soon as they appear, they fly at somebody's throat. They're like mosquitoes, vicious from the moment of their birth." American diplomats and military attachés who were perhaps unfamiliar with European history and European conflict would no doubt have been surprised by the fact that at the end of the most bloody war in human history, that there was seemingly an unending appetite for further conflict in Europe. In fact, there seemed to be almost nothing that could prevent further conflict in Europe when the issue of national self-determination was raised. Now, in order to understand this, you know, you need to really go very deeply into the origins and theory of nationalism, far, far deeper than we can go today. But as I always recommend, get Benedict Anderson's Imagined Communities. One of the questions that Benedict Anderson sets himself is how and why people respond so passionately to these strange concepts we invent for ourselves called nations. What is it about the nation that will have individuals fight and kill and devote such energies? He goes, has a vastly illuminating thesis in the book. I won't spoil it here, but it's well worth getting your hands on. One interesting difference between 1919 and 1945 was the power that the victorious powers had in both periods to actually reshape Europe. In 1945, the power to decide the futures of everywhere from Poland to Greece is far greater than that possessed in 1919. The level of destruction of Germany, the outright defeat of Germany, far, far greater in 1945, obviously. Unconditional surrender and the full military occupation of Germany was a possibility then. And it meant that the countries liberated from Nazi Germany by both sides, by the Western and by the Soviet Union, Westerners and the Soviet Union, had the scope to be to have their borders changed, particularly in the case of Poland, in a way that wasn't possible in 1919. The establishment of Poland by a national insurrection meant that the kind of the facts on the ground weighed and mattered an awful lot more than they did in 1945.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Some of the rewriting of boundaries, particularly in the case of Turkey, is violently overthrown in the immediate aftermath of the Paris Peace Conference and the few years following it. And such an event in the aftermath of the Second World War, where there are millions of Soviet soldiers in Europe and the Americans have a monopoly on the atomic bomb, would have been almost unthinkable, the idea that anyone dare challenge or overthrow the post-war order, at least for the first decade or so, was really highly unlikely indeed. And as I pointed out in the previous podcast I've done on the Paris Peace Conference, the ability of the British, the Americans and the Soviets to plan out a world order long before the defeat of Nazi Germany meant that there were, in essence, fewer surprises for either side. The abruptness of the end of the First World War, so the long struggle against the Central Powers and the final rapid collapse, meant that the peacemakers were taken, in essence, rather by surprise and had to go about the process of peacemaking, of nation building, of the reconstruction of Europe, or the attempted reconstruction of Europe, from scratch, with very little formal idea of what they wanted or how they wanted to go about it. And certainly very little understanding of how competing claims between themselves and also the contradictory ambitions of various states within Europe, from disgruntled combatants like Italy to pariah states like Germany and the Soviet Union, to new nations like Hungary and Czechoslovakia. This kind of chaos was very difficult to manage, particularly as it was largely unanticipated. Peacemakers were unaware of the limitations, the practical limitations, to their own power. There were a large number of delegates at the conference who thought that this was an opportunity for a grand reconciliation of peoples in Europe and around the world, that wrongs could be set right. But the fact that there were so many competing claims on morality and on the rights and wrongs of nations meant that this was highly unlikely. And the conference becomes a forum for all sorts of largely unwelcome and uninvited colonial subjects who, in their view, mapped onto it all sorts of meanings that the Allied powers had not intended. When Ho Chi Minh was working as a kitchen assistant in the Ritz in Paris, he sent a petition acting essentially as a de facto ambassador to colonised Vietnam, asking for independence. The fact that this was considered so trivial and was considered so far away from the main topic of the conference was made clear when he didn't receive any kind of response at all. Ordinary Parisians would have been forgiven for thinking that the whole purpose of the conference was to punish Germany, not to decide questions such as Vietnamese independence. This seemed preposterous. There were, however, many thousands, perhaps even hundreds of thousands, of Chinese people who viewed the Paris Peace Conference in an entirely different light. The Chinese had not participated militarily in the First World War, not to any great extent anyway. It supplied labourers for the Western Front. And so the cheering in the streets when the armistice was announced and when the conference began might have been something of a mystery to Western onlookers. What is it possibly that the Chinese could find interesting about something that seemed to be a wholly European affair? Well, in their view, the perspective that they had on it, or the wish that they projected onto the kind of empty slate of the conference, was that it would be a moment of international reconciliation and a moment whereby Europeans would decide to do the right thing, where justice would be done by China and things such as treaty ports and extraterritoriality for Europeans on Chinese territory and the unequal treaties inflicted on China from the 1840s onwards. These would be undone and China would have its independence. This was the view that many Chinese people had. However, as we will find out, or as you may well know, the Japanese, who had been allies to the British and the Allied powers during the First World War, they get first say on what happens with China, particularly what happens with the Shandong Peninsula. The British were very awkward about China's offer of assistance to the Western Allies during the war. The White House, in a kind of rather patronising way, thanks China for its kind offer of half a million troops to the Western Front, but turns them down anyway, assuming that this will be a ploy to get concessions, and already there was going to be some kind of awkward horse trading with Japan. Woodrow Wilson was keen to get Japan on board for the League of Nations and knew that perhaps granting them some sort of rights in China would be just the medicine for that. The conference attracts not only delegates from around the world, but also not only delegates, I beg your pardon, from nation states or from colonised nations looking for their independence, but also from sectional interests, with female suffrage societies met in Paris, and Millicent Fawcett from the National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies in Great Britain. Lucy represented the movement in Paris and became something of a kind of a focal figure. Wilson was not entirely opposed to the movement for female suffrage and had sympathies for the cause. He did what American presidents tend to do, met with delegations and spoke in very general terms about how good it would be for the rights of women and the vote to be enhanced, but left himself free of any meaningful commitment and suggested that a special commission should be set up and that this would have women, female members, and it would look into the issues for women. Wilson mentioned this to Arthur Balfour, who had sympathies for the British suffrage movement. The French thought, yes, there should be something done about female suffrage. The Italians poured more cold water on the issue, saying, well, it's more of a domestic matter and for something for individual nation states to deal with. And the Japanese said, really, well, this is nothing to do with the Paris Peace Conference. And whilst we recognise the contribution of women to the world, it's a kind of a sideshow. It's not what we're here to achieve. Now, as old empires collapsed and the Allied powers suddenly found themselves responsible for, in some ways, rather unexpected parts of the world, quickly finding local elites and politicians who seemed promising, who were rose to prominence in these new successor states, was quite a difficult task. If this was not done quickly, chaos would rule in large parts of Eastern Europe and the Middle East, and the chances of the Bolsheviks being able to expand into these territories or them having other kinds of violent revolutionary uprisings was definitely there, i.e. you pick the strong man or one will emerge not of your choosing. The local occupying armies in Europe and the Middle East were very often the only glue that held societies together. The quick thinking and lateral thinking of Allied officers was very often essential in getting communications, infrastructure, trade, healthcare, and other basic aspects of life going again in war-shattered parts of the world. In Belgrade, a British admiral put together a small flotilla of barges and moved them up and down the Danube, moving food and raw materials, which again brought about a vitally needed rejuvenation of markets and trade, which made sure that people didn't starve. There's always an interesting parallel between that and, say, the era of war communism in Russia, which was emerging at about the same time, where any kind of trade was shut down, almost guaranteeing famine. John Maynard Keynes, in his book The Economic Consequences of the Peace, led a stinging indictment of the peacemakers at Paris, saying that the most important thing of rejuvenating and resurrecting world trade, that hadn't happened, and this was a great oversight on part of the Allied powers. The responsibilities for the peacemakers were enormous. The European and world economy was in chaos, and the amounts of debt that had been accrued to fight the war were vast. Working out how to repay the debt and how to keep the kind of the flow of repayments from Germany to the Allied powers in terms of reparations and from Britain and France to America in terms of the servicing of war loans was going to prove a major and ultimately insurmountable headache. Anyway, I'm going to finish this podcast here because there's an awful lot more on this subject to say. We'll look a bit more later in the week on the chaos that Europe faces in 1919, and then we'll move on to examining Russia. Thanks very much for listening. I'll catch you on the next podcast. And thanks very much everyone who's been engaged in the conversation we've had over the weekend on the subject of hate speech. All the best and bye-bye.